want to say just a very few words to try to frame the discussion we're going to have. So the way I think about this topic, at least, is that we're going to talk today largely about financial technologies. Financial technologies, I think, are very flexible, and they can move resources across time and space. So moving across time means you move money from a good year to a bad year. Moving across space, you move money from a place not affected by shocks to a place affected by shocks. We're going to look at a bunch of different technologies today. And as we think about them, one thing I want to have us in the back of our minds as we go through them are some differences between them that I think that are consequential. So we're going to have some discussion about insurance. So as we think about insurance, two dimensions here that I think matter. It's often expensive. So given the markup of insurance, for me to get a dollar in a time of need, it often costs me $1.60. That is, we often see 60% markup. So that $1 I get is expensive. Now, a lot of us are working on trying to bring that price down to $1.27, which is what it costs to buy agricultural insurance in the United States. But it's expensive. On the other hand, as long as you have the money, there aren't any other barriers to accessing it. You pay your money, you get your protection. Right? We can think about credit as an alternative way to do this. Credit's less expensive. If the interest rate is 25%, you can kind of think that a dollar today, you kind of have to pay $1.25 when you repay the loan. So that dollar costs you money, but it doesn't cost you $1.60. Even a high interest rate of 25% costs you about $25. And those of you who are economists are probably feeling sick to your stomachs. I'm not doing present value, but just to make the point, right? On the other hand, you know, the barriers of access to credit are different. You have to be credit worthy. You need collateral assets. So that's not everybody can do it. So it's a little bit more restrictive in terms of what you can do. We can also think about savings as another way to move money through time or space. And if you get if you actually get a positive rate of interest on your savings, if you want a dollar tomorrow in time of need, you actually only have to save about 95 cents now because you're going to get an interest return on it, right? So that money is much, much, much cheaper to the person. On the other hand, you have to have the money to save, right? So you can't be dirt poor and insure yourself with saving. And the final thing, and it's one that we're going to talk about today, are transfers. That is money that can come across space or time from other people. And how costly that is depends on who sends you the money, right? The money could be sent by your government, in which case what you need is you need political citizenship and voice in order to get that money. Not everybody has that, and that's part of the issue of kinds of exclusion. If you're getting money from your family and friends who might send it to you in time of need, you need those social assets, and maybe you need to have good social relationships, you need to be able to collateralize it. So how expensive it is depends on what your family extracts from you in return from helping you out in time of need, and or what the government perhaps extracts from you. Anyway, as we go forward here, then I'd just like to suggest that we keep these things in mind, and I think it's important because it suggests that while these are all ways of moving money across time and space, they actually differ in some fundamentally important ways. To me, this suggests complementarities between these instruments, and it may particularly suggest that if we think about a person going through their life cycle, as we go through our life cycle, we may have very few assets or credit worthiness or even social relationships or political capital at the beginning, and those things evolve over time, which may suggest that there may be an optimum way of kind of mixing these instruments as we go through time. The final thing, a point I want to make, and I hope you like one. This is a logo I came up with. I didn't copyright it because I'm a fool. But this is a maize insurance project in Tanzania. So that's the little maize cob with his shield of protection there. But work we've done on the impacts of risk management suggests there are two kinds of impacts. One are the ex post recovery effects, and I think that's what we normally think about. But I think a lot of the research shows that the more powerful effects are actually how you change your behavior ex ante when you know you are protected. So I call those here ex ante investment effects. Now I think as we go across our discussion today and we think about these different instruments, I think it's useful to focus on do they actually differ in these ways, and I think particularly in the ex ante way. So I guess Chris Barrett and I have worked with for a long time, Andrew Mude, recently looked at the Kenya Livestock Insurance Program, and they did an informal interview with people insured by that program, and you know, 98% of the people didn't know they were insured because it was a free program and it was sort of politically allocated. Well, clearly, if you don't know you were insured, the ex ante impacts are going to be zero. Right? Whereas if I'm forced to pay $1.60 for every dollar of expected protection, I know pretty well that I'm insured, and we may expect some differences in those kinds of things. So I think as we, you know, so I'll turn it over now to our speakers who are going to talk about these different instruments, how they might work. And as we come to our discussion, we might want to think about these issues of complementarity and differences between them. So without further ado, I did learn how to spell Chris's name correctly because I've known him for a long time. I won't tell you how long it took me, Chris. And so, Chris, I don't know if you want to speak here or just sit there, whatever.
Well, thank you, Michael, and thank you to the organizers for having me here. It's a pleasure to get to participate in this conversation. In my 1.5 minutes or whatever crazy short amount of time I have, I'm going to present largely other people's work, which is always an interesting take for an academic. But let me frame the work, the empirical results I'll present to you in a moment. We've had a lot of discussions about evidence of impacts. There's been relatively little discussion about the background method, so that I'm not always sure I understand exactly why a line slopes down, what it's capturing, et cetera. To be precise, the evidence I'm going to talk about all derives from a framing of resilience that Mark Constas and I put together a few years ago, which we call development resilience, which is a very specific, theoretically grounded approach to thinking about resilience of populations exposed to shocks and stressors. The core challenge of that approach is resilience is unobservable, although that pervades any definition of resilience pretty much. It's a latent variable. And the approach to trying to estimate resilience then really does matter. Our approach to it, the way Mark and I conceptualize this, resilience is a way of understanding the stochastic dynamics of people's well-being. However you think about well-being, whether it's their food security status, their asset holdings, their psychosocial self-efficacy, any of a variety of different metrics one might reasonably think about, you need high-frequency data of some sort. You need some time series, which makes it imposing if you don't have other reason to collect data. And it's part of the reason some of us, Derek Hetty and I, for example, have made a case for sentinel sites for high-frequency data collection. Now, that's the background. There's a very specific theory that informs the method that generates the evidence I'll report in just a moment. The method largely owes to Jen Cisse from USAID, who's right up here. I had the good fortune to have Jen as a PhD student. She just completed earlier this year. Congratulations, Jen. So Jen and I have a paper that maps out how to operationalize this theory of development resilience that Mark and I published a few years ago in panel data, when you observe a household, an individual over time. So Jen and I have a method, the core of which is, without getting deep in the weeds, the core of which is just like poverty measurement. Indeed, it is built expressly as an analog to Foster Greer Thorbeck poverty measurement. Just like poverty measurement, establish some threshold level of well-being above which you want everyone to be, so a poverty line, if you will, and some threshold tolerance level of the probability of not reaching that. You know, what's our tolerance for risk that people don't meet this standard of living or this measure of food security? And the combination of these two intrinsically arbitrary lines, and I emphasize, they're intrinsically arbitrary. All poverty lines are intrinsically arbitrary. But the combination of those two lines, then we can actually measure very precisely. We can estimate resilience. And moreover, it has some nice properties that Jen in my paper goes into, that you can build the analogs to poverty measures. You can get headcount measures in populations of how many people are resilient or are not resilient. And then you can also make inferences, look at the change in the population that is resilient within a given area over a given period of time. And it's that property that is fairly useful for trying to build the evidence base, that we can do rigorous impact evaluation if we can isolate something that we think is plausibly exogenous, whether it comes from a randomized controlled trial, an act of nature, a carefully measured, designed program where we understand what puts people into one group versus another and therefore can control for selection. Whatever the method you want to do, as long as you have a reasonably rigorous design, you can now establish the impact on resilience defined and measured that way. And that prologue was all to just make clear, there's a very specific theory and method that informs the evidence that I'll present to you. And I emphasize this is all very preliminary. None of these are yet peer-reviewed published papers. They're all relatively recent, but they all use exactly that method. So in that sense, they're directly comparable. We don't worry that, oh, we're getting results because we're mixing up a bunch of methods and it's not quite clear whether you get the same results with different methods. So a couple of very important positive findings underscoring Michael's point. The first is some of you have heard of index-based livestock insurance. Greg kindly gave us a shout out this morning. IBLI was created in January 2010. We launched it as a pilot in northern Kenya with a private provider. It's run out of the International Livestock Research Institute in Nairobi. We developed variants of it in Ethiopia, customized to the Barana context, a Sharia-compliant version for northeastern Kenya. It's now gone nationwide in Kenya as the Kenya Livestock Insurance Program. So Jen and one of the IBLI team, Nobuo Kigami, did a very nice evaluation of the impacts, the causal effects of IBLI on resilience measured a couple of different ways. First, the primary asset, livestock herding, livestock herd size, and second, child health as reflected by mid-upper arm circumference. And you find very strong evidence that IBLI builds resilience measured in terms of people's ability to maintain a herd over time of adequate size, people's ability to maintain children of adequate health over time. Separate evaluation done by Hope Michelson and a team from University of Illinois on a heifer project in Zambia, they find that asset transfers, which are basically free credit, we give you money and you don't have to pay anything back. A transfer is just a different way of moving assets across time and individuals. But they find very similarly that this builds resilience among recipient households with a very high benefit cost ratio. I should mention, by the way, a separate study that we just published in Journal of Development Economics finds a very high benefit cost ratio for IBLI, indeed substantially higher, an order of magnitude higher at the margin than cash transfers among the same population. But the big conclusion here is interventions that address the financial market failures faced by these populations. They can't get credit, they can't get insurance until we develop some sort of substitute. Those interventions seem to really pay off fairly substantially in terms of the improved resilience for the rural poor in these contexts in Africa. One negative finding, coming from a different paper Jen wrote, using the LSMS ISA data from Uganda, is that we often talk about diversification as a strategy. But observe that diversification is a strategy people already practice. Oftentimes, it's practiced as risk management, trading off variance for mean. So people choose a low-return, low-risk strategy to guard against catastrophic losses. As a result, driving people towards more diversification may or may not actually enhance their ability to live a life with an adequate standard of living over a period of time. So what Jen finds, and this is not causal, I would emphasize just the nature of LSMS-ISA, but there is a negative association between diversification, both crop diversification and income diversification for resilience among the poor. The key here is to recognize that diversification is an adaptive response people naturally take on to avoid an even worse outcome. So this does not tell us what would happen if you offered people a new instrument that they could diversify their livelihoods with. This is among the existing set of options available to people. So the very limited evidence thus far available using this theory and this method points to things we would expect, that diversification is a natural existing response. In the absence of some new option for the portfolio, it's not clear this is going to improve livelihoods or resilience, but we do find that interventions that enhance people's access to finance do build resilience among the rural poor.
Thanks. So I'm going to talk about the African risk capacity, which is also insurance. It's an index-based sovereign level risk insurance platform that was developed, or it was founded by African Union member states themselves. One of the things I want to talk about first, though, is through the different sessions that have been in the value for money session, something that's come up and inside conversations that's come up is it's a continuum of activities that we're engaging in for resilience, but really resilience to natural disasters calls for two different things. investments in chronic, to help respond to chronic risks and frequent shocks. And this, as I said, came up in the Value for Money panel the other day when someone pointed out that it's not necessarily realistic to expect that you're going to build resilience to shocks that are a 1 to 15 year shock. For something like that, you need risk management. And so the focus of ARC is to engage at a level where a country would be taking out the insurance to respond to less and less frequent events. We have countries now that take out insurance for 1 in 3 year events, and the idea is that as resilience is built to more frequent shocks, the countries will start to take out less and less frequent insurance. And I think it's an important thing to bear in mind when we think about things like the cost of taking out insurance and the value of risk pooling, that it's we're talking about less frequent events. So just to go back to what ARC does, ARC's a sovereign index insurance that the countries that engage with us, they go through a capacity building program, and through that they customize a software platform that we have that puts together their weather, satellite weather data, crop information, water requirements and crop information, and they puts that on top of vulnerability information. So the country can customize the insurance that it is taking out, and they're paying for this insurance. They customize it based on what kind of vulnerability and what kind of event they want to be responding to. So they get to make this decision about the frequency of event that they respond to. And they also get to make decisions about what kind of people have benefit from their response, in the sense of what percentage are they dependent on agriculture, what percentage of the poverty line, are they at the poverty line as defined by the country. Once the country has made this decision, they develop a contingency plan that explains what they're going to do with the funds once they get them. So the contingency plan allows them to act extremely quickly. Before we founded this, we launched ARC, we commissioned a cost-benefit analysis that was conducted by IFPRI and Oxford University by Janet Clark, who's now at DFID, that found that this early action, and because it's index-based, it can pay out at the end of the insurance, at the end of a growing cycle. So a country insures its harvest, and then the payout can happen immediately at the end of the harvest because the payout is based on a predefined trigger, and there's a predefined plan that explains what the country will be doing with the funds. So the idea is that we could, theoretically, pay out within 2 weeks of the end of the harvest, which is well before the countries, the populations would be engaging in their negative coping mechanisms. The cost-benefit analysis found that $1 expended through ARC in this way, with this very rapid early response, would be equivalent to $4.40 in traditional late humanitarian assistance. So the key to all of this is the contingency planning and the speed. Once, again, we're talking about droughts, we're working towards products for floods and tropical cyclones and epidemics as well. But for now, the thing about the flood and the use of the widespread use of the software means that everybody is observing the same information regarding whether a payment will be triggered or not. So the country has the ability, before the end of the season even occurs, to develop their new plan. So they need a first plan before they take out insurance, and when an event is going to happen, they need a more detailed plan, a final implementation plan that looks exactly at the event that they are having and comes up with a specific response to it. So far, we're right now, 2017, forming our fourth risk pool. We've had 4 payouts so far, that's the listing up there, and that's the first 3 on the list, Senegal, Mauritania, and Niger, were all the response to the end of 2014 drought. These paid out in early 2015, and Malawi is the 2016 drought. So this lists what the countries said that they were going to be using the money for, and in fact did. So they had the contingency plans, they came up with these a menu of activities initially. This is what they came down with finally, and there were modifications as it went along. There were things that didn't turn out right. I mean, not didn't turn out right, but things that didn't, on the ground, turn out the way that they were expecting, and so there were modifications, which we allow. And we have auditing data for the first 3. Malawi, we don't have it yet. The polls aren't done. But just to say, how did we do? Because all of this are one $4 to $4.40 is based on early quick response. Mauritania did the best. They got their payout. All three of those countries filed their final implementation plans in the beginning of December 2014. They are reviewed by an independent committee and went back for more evaluation or improvement to the plans, and they finally had their plans approved in January, and they had Mauritania and Senegal got payouts at the end of January. The OCHA appeal for the Sahel didn't even launch until the end of February, and they already had money in their treasuries at the end of January. Mauritania was able to translate that into responses to their vulnerable populations by April. So they were already dispersing funds in April, which is well, again, within the window before populations were engaging in negative coping mechanisms. We don't do the kind of rigorous statistical analysis that a lot of the other participants do, but we do spot checking. So this is not representative necessarily of the entire population, but in spot checks, people in Mauritania reported that 40% of the households interviewed said that food distribution prevented migration. 46% said that food distribution had prevented the distressed sale of livestock in the previous 4 months. And 100% said the number of meals that they were consuming had increased to 2 out of 3 per day over the preceding 4 months. So we feel like that's, we have, again, we're a new organization and we have recently taken on much more M&E capacity that will help us really pin these numbers down, and we're commissioning a new cost-benefit analysis, but we feel like these statistics bear out the proof of concept. In some of the other countries, it was slower for reasons that have little to do with the contingency planning, everything to do with internal government mechanisms, and in some cases, a reluctance to declare a drought that would have allowed the government to start employing emergency measures that are not able to do other times, and also a varying sense of urgency in the responses. But even in Senegal, which was quite delayed, we found that 84% said that rice distribution had prevented the sale of livestock or other possessions in that 6 month period. So we are working on better analysis and speeding things up, but we think that so far the data has borne out our concept that just kind of early response can be very helpful to the household level.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to stand. Great morning, everyone. Thank you again to the organizers for inviting us. From Innovations for Poverty Action, we are a global nonprofit research organization that conducts impact evaluations all over the globe. I work for our financial inclusion program, which studies the way that households and individuals interact with financial tools and then the impacts of financial services. So I realize now, listening to the other presentations, that I went real wide, not deep, so I'm going to throw a ton of studies at you, kind of like one-liners, and then we can maybe discuss some of this stuff as part of the discussion. So I think the biggest takeaway from the work that I'm going to present is that the tools that people are using, financial instruments as tools, do have an important impact on outcomes when it comes to building resilience, right? So as you're looking at these studies, think about the tools themselves and then what barriers still exist to accessing and using these tools and how we can make these tools more efficient for users. So the first thing I want to talk about is the role of digital payments. So we have some exciting evidence on digital payments, which suggests that that they are effective in improving the risk-sharing capacity of households and networks, right? So two quick studies on that. One, looking at domestic transfers in Kenya. We have a study from William Jack and Tavni Itsuri on M-Pesa, the mobile money tool in Kenya, and just looking at changes in consumption after the introduction of M-Pesa. And so we see that for M-Pesa users, following a drought, those households experienced no drop in consumption compared to a 6 to 10% reduction in consumption among households who did not use M-Pesa. So why did we see that difference, right? It's not because there was a specific intervention. It was the tool of the mobile money tool itself, which allowed those households to draw resources from from people they might not otherwise be able to draw resources from, right? So think about the way that, you know, that family members or neighbors would help each other before the introduction of digital, of mobile money. You know, cash, people from people in your communities coming over and giving you cash, but maybe, you know, everybody in the community is affected by the same shock as you are, and so there's less resources there. Or somebody who's living in a city far away who wants to send cash but has to do so by, you know, giving it to a bus driver or something like that, where you don't really know if it's going to get there or how long it'll take. So just the introduction of this tool made this risk sharing more efficient, right? And we do see that impact on household consumption as a result. I'm going to switch down to the bottom one. International remittances are kind of the same idea, right? So instead of just domestic transfers, we're talking about cross-border transfers here. Remittances are obviously very responsive to shocks, to weather-related disasters, things like that. So our researchers here, this is not an RCT, but Dean Yang and his co-author looked at the impact of international remittances on households that were affected by income shocks related to rainfall, and saw that over time, I think this was like 1 or 2 year period, international remittances replaced 60% of lost household domestic income as a result of these rainfall shocks. So let's think about, when we're thinking about you know, mobile money or, you know, just digital payments in general, if these international remittances or domestic remittances, these, you know, informal flows are so important, what can we be doing to build appropriate infrastructure to make sure those payments are affordable, more efficient, and that the appropriate infrastructure is there to allow people to make the investments they want to make once they receive that money. And then going back up to the middle, this idea of cash transfers, I think we all understand the value of cash transfers, but in this study from Jenny Aker, we're looking at the difference between cash transfers paid out in a just straight cash model versus payout as a digital payment. So we're just switching the way that the cash transfer is getting distributed. And we see a large difference in impact just based on that switch. So the particular program that that Jenny was looking at for the study was targeting women, cash transfers to women after a drought. So they saw that just the introduction of the digital payments increased diet diversity within the household, increased the amount of food consumed by the household, and empowerment of women. And by empowerment of women, I mean the women who were the intended beneficiaries were more likely to actually be the final recipients of the money. So it was reducing the risk that you know, somebody else in the household would make a demand on the money, or even, you know, go to the place to actually pick up the money in the woman's name. So this is just from a switch in distribution methods. And quickly moving on, again, savings is a really important tool. And some of the work that we've been involved in is looking at how to remove barriers to savings. So that's both the cost of products themselves and also behavioral barriers. This morning, we were talking a little bit about nudges. That's where this idea of nudges enters in, right? So we you know, saving, building up a saving stock is much more difficult than paying a loan, right? Because you're very much responsible to yourself. You have to maintain a savings habit. And you have to continue that habit over time, right? So there are really important behavioral barriers to achieving, you know, long-term savings that we can also correct for in product design. So again, these are just examples of some studies that looked at what happens after you remove some of the cost to savings, both behavioral, and that's through labeling. Some of these were products that included a label for its intended use, which is a light touch commitment contract. And then also what would happen when fees were eliminated, there was no, you know, minimum deposit required and no cost to open the accounts, right? So across the board, we're seeing the first study and the last study in Nepal and in Chile, we saw that when no fee accounts were offered, we saw you know, smaller drops in income after a health shock, increases in health-related expenditures, compared to those who did not have a savings account in Nepal. And then in Chile, in the bottom one, we also looked at, we saw reductions in consumption cutbacks associated with negative income shocks. So there was a 44% reduction in consumption cutbacks, it's a confusing way to say it, for among those people who had access to the no-cost savings account. And we also saw that people were substituting savings for credit. as well. So in that population as well, there's a reduction in short-term debt by about 20%, and that was mostly informal debt to friends and family. So people were replacing that more expensive short-term debt with the savings that they had accumulated in these no-cost savings accounts, which is, I think, important because it's a, you know, a cheaper and more sustainable way of recovering after minor shocks, right? And then the study in the middle is a study on savings groups, which is a different type of product, but not offered by a formal financial institution necessarily. And we also saw positive impacts on resilience, although not definitive or not transformative, right? So I think there's a need for more studies there and more research on how we can use these village savings and loans groups, or these informal savings groups, as a way to build resilience versus traditional bank account in a bank. And then finally, real quick, I think we're going to talk a lot more about insurance in the discussion, but going to Michael's earlier comment about the way that people change their behavior when they know that they are protected against a risk, a few studies from our researchers would show that people make different investment decisions when they know up front that they have insurance to protect them from rainfall-related risk, right? So the important study from Dean Carlin and his co-authors on rainfall index insurance would show that really the limitations to making larger investments in agricultural inputs or agricultural activities or in diversification of agricultural activities, the main constraint there was not a capital constraint. It was really risk aversion. So by introducing an insurance product, we saw different decisions in terms of the amount of land cultivated, the types of crops cultivated, things like that. And then just quickly, a second study in Senegal and Burkina Faso, which looked at offer of insurance products to men and women and compared that to the offer of savings accounts, also showed that women who took up the insurance product invested more in their agricultural activities, had higher average yields, better managed food insecurity and income shocks. But I think the trick there with that study was that there was relatively low demand for the insurance product among women versus the demand and use of the savings product, which is an interesting finding. And the authors there kind of hypothesized that because of the way that women work in agriculture or the types of work that they're doing, they actually perceive health-related risks to be more important than rainfall-related. So they would choose to use a savings account that was labeled for health expenditures over an insurance product because they perceive that health-related challenges would be would make their situation worse off or more largely impact their ability to work, if that makes sense. So I think we have to make this is just a call for more research again on understanding demand for insurance products, understanding what people's perceived risks are, and making sure that we're developing products that respond to those risks, and then understanding the gender difference as well. Understanding that there is not a one-size-fits-all product. I think this insurance study is a good example of that, of differences by gender. Also looking at the way that digital payments and transfers can target women more directly, give women more privacy and control over the money that they're getting in, and then looking at differences in consumption and investment when women have that control, when they're able to use those digital products. So I know that's a lot. I'll stop there.
Okay, great.
My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So thank you to all of our speakers that we covered quite a waterfront there. So let's just open it up, I think, straight away for discussion. So we'll take a couple of have responses and go around. Identify yourself, please.
Yeah, my name is Katie Downey. I work for the SOMRAP project in Somalia. This is a question for Chris Barrett. How have you found the uptake of the insurance service across northern Kenya and in other areas in Ethiopia, for example? Has there been much resistance, and how? I know you work with a local broker. Because it's sort of a very different type of project culturally, what's been some of the methods you've used, and have you found that it is consistently steady, or are there patterns, et cetera, et cetera?
Hi, good to hear from Oxfam. It's on insurance, and I just wanted to flag up that in two recent reports that have looked at the evidence around insurance, So one by MCII that came out in November last year, which looks at the whether insurance does build resilient and absorptive, adaptive, transformative capacity. And basically found, looked at 18 different schemes, and basically found very little evidence, publicly available evidence, these schemes actually do build resilience. Not that they don't build resilience, but that there's just so little evidence. And actually, Italy, Kenya, and the R4 program are the two schemes which have actually good M&E. But the other schemes have very, very little that's publicly available. And an OBI report just came out last week, but again, looking at the same kind of issues, but in a slightly different way. And again, found very little evidence. And what we haven't read today are the schemes that have failed and some of the problems with insurance, which is perhaps much further. But basis risk is something that you probably ought to mention when you talk about insurance. And actually, a lot of insurance in developing countries is not possible to do without subsidies of some description, whether that's from the government or whether that's from a donor. So if you're looking at public money going into supporting insurance, then I think we need much stronger M&E that this is the right use of the money and it's better to put insurance versus social protection or DRR or whatever it is. So I think for me, there's a big question about M&E. Do we have the right M&E for insurance and do we have the evidence to show that insurance in general is a good thing? Clearly, there are a few good schemes, but I think there are some big gaps.
Then we'll come down the left side in a second. All right, we won't go there. I think very simply and linearly. Three hands went up in a row, so I couldn't resist.
Thanks so much. Kate McKee from the Partnership for Economic Inclusion. So I'm picking up on Rebecca's point. Financial services tend to be purchased by individuals. There may or may not be hostile decision-making. And they tend to be pretty gendered, not to generalize or anything. But I'm just wondering how this affects this kind of view that we're looking at of the inside the household and resilience perspective and the different incentives and options that they place. I also just want to caution to be the first to be a little careful on some of the digital payments because you know, we have one study that shows one thing and one study that shows something else. Place. And so I guess that's generally true, but it's not very proven yet, in my view, about the actual welfare effects of digital payments.
Okay. So, Chris, you want to go first, and then we'll go to Rebecca, and then I would like to jump in.
Sure. Thank you. Good questions and comments. Let me take them in order. So, Katie, So uptake of index-based livestock insurance, the first generation product, the original pilot product underwritten by a company called UAP and Marsabit, uptake was in the initial round about 22% of surveyed households. Keep in mind that is going to be distorted upwards by the fact that they were part of a M&E design where we gave them coupons to discount the purchase, we had randomized trainings, et cetera. So all of that is going to push upwards uptake rate. So 22% is a relatively good uptake rate, but that's certainly not the population, the untreated population, nothing like that. The second generation product, a little bit higher, the version in southern Ethiopia from Aromi Insurance Company, a little higher still. All of these, one of the crucial features we see is lots of people buying the product and then disadopting it and not buying it when the insurance lapses. Some people go in and out of insurance. They buy some seasons, don't buy others, which raises important questions of why they do that. Are they identifying a weakness in pricing that enables them to take advantage of the fact that they think they have better information about the true cost of risk at a given moment? But it begs the question, is it that they're gaming it or that they tried it and found it to not be a great product? It's an open question. We don't, frankly, have a great answer to that right now, other than evaluation data would suggest it, on average, does pretty well for people. The product has now gone nationwide in Kenya, as you know, but as Michael was saying earlier, a large majority of the people who are insured don't even know that they're insured because the government has simply provided the product. So I'm not sure what uptake means in that kind of context. So the bottom, over half of the populations we've tracked over time in northern Kenya and southern Ethiopia have purchased Iblee at some point in the initial 3 years of offering of the contract. So a pretty high rate of people trying it, but again, distorted upwards by encouragement designs in the M&E. The caution about insurance is very well taken. I completely agree with you that the jury's out. There are important reasons to wonder about the overall efficacy of, and here I want to separate micro insurance of the sort I was describing for IBLI from macro insurance of the sort Erica's describing with ARC. First, there's product design. There are some really badly designed index insurance products out there. In our team in IBLI, we've constantly had the conversation, are we selling insurance or are we selling lottery tickets? We need to be very confident we're not selling poor people lottery tickets. Most people have no clue which they're selling, to be blunt, because just don't understand the basis risk structure of the product. A good product, I think we now have decent evidence, a good product can generate a real payoff. A bad product, we can almost always suspect will probably do harm because of, and this is the second point, pricing. This is not a terribly competitive market space right now. As Michael was suggesting, markups are big. So 60% loadings on average is much higher than we see in relatively competitive insurance markets. So a lot of us have, between these two features of product design and product pricing, been pushing for what some of us, Michael and I and others, call safe minimum standards. Some way of establishing a mechanism of enforcing quality and reasonably competitive pricing in insurance products available in these settings. Because without those two, you should neither expect good uptake nor positive effects. The third and big question is the opportunity cost. Is insurance the best use of very scarce dollars in these settings? To the best of my knowledge, the only reasonably rigorous horse race run thus far is the one that a group of us did comparing the Hunger Safety Nets program, HSNP, which is a cash transfer in northern Kenya, with IBLI, same population, same period of time, careful identification, so we're pretty confident we've got good benchmarks, and at the margin, IBLI was an order of magnitude higher benefit-cost ratio. Both have a benefit-cost ratio well in excess of one, but IBLI's was considerably higher for the simple reason that the private sector is taking on an awful lot of the risk. Does that tell us this is universally a good use of resources? No. Have we run the horse race against any other prospective interventions? No. These are very open, important questions. I don't think that is settled by any stretch of the imagination.
As long as we're on insurance, Erica, did you want to chime in anything before we switch gears a little bit?
I'll just add that basis risk is obviously for us a huge issue, right? Because what we're having is very infrequent large payments to governments. So if you have a basis risk event, it's a huge issue. And we're looking at various ways to respond to that response mechanisms. There are other similar entities that have basis risk funds that they can pay out of. But I think our other issue, which relates to the uptake and not taking insurance, et cetera, is that we have, even for countries that have had payouts, payment fatigue, where they do, a certain set of decision makers, we're talking about, it's a political setup, certain set of decision makers makes the decision that insurance is a good idea, and then it's a different set of decision makers the next year, or they don't feel like they're getting payouts on a frequent enough basis, and they allocate their funds in a different way. So that's definitely a huge challenge that we're facing now in trying to figure out how, because all of our countries are funding their own premiums, right? So trying to understand how we could make that more affordable with the intervention of, some of the IFIs or other donors, et cetera, to make that work out so it's a more constant safety net. Although, as we just said, there's not a ton of evidence about whether this is the most effective use of funding. We believe that it is, but there is obviously a lot more work to be done.
If I can abuse my chair position, since I've been suffering on this topic for about a dozen years, let me just make a couple of really quick comments too. I think this basis risk issue is huge. First paper, to sound like my president, huge. The second paper I wrote on this topic was called Intelligent Design of Index Insurance Contracts, which I love the title, but I lost about 10 friends because of that, because it obviously implied there were a lot of stupidly designed contracts. And basis risk is knowable if you do your homework, and I think part of the problem here is that people have not wanted to know. I think there was excess enthusiasm maybe early on for this, and you know, the evidence is kind of mixed. I mean, just one other thought I want to throw out there is, you know, we often focus on price of insurance, and I do that as well, but it's also the contract terms. Because, you know, you ask someone how much you're going to pay for something, and you really don't know what it's worth, right? I have a paper that entirely statistically relies on the fact that people are very sensitive to where the strike points are set. Okay, this is actually what explained uptake in a fairly high impact program in Mali, is we had a single price and everyone goes, well, is that a good deal? I don't really know. But when they were told, when some farmers were told, because of the way the reinsurance pricing went, they would only get paid if yields were below something their grandfathers had never seen, they said, well, obviously it's bad. And when other people said, were given price for higher strike points, that is the level of yields below which insurance pays out, people could relate to that, right? And that's just the flip side of the price. But it's actually a metric that people understand. And so I think sometimes, you know, we as economists at least fetishize price, but the price for something you don't understand is a little bit hard to understand, I think, for farmers. So anyway, lots to continue. So Rebecca, I interrupted you. As you go back inside the household.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Kate, for your comments. Just to address, I guess, the gender issue, I think absolutely, you know, women and men within the household could have, you know, potentially different preferences, different priorities for investments, and you know, demand products that are designed to take into those you know, changes, those differences and preferences into account, right? So again, going back to this insurance study, you know, women saw that they, like, their ability to work was likely to be more impacted by health-related issues, you know, things surrounding childbirth or health of their children, things like that. That for them was the biggest priority to guard against, and you know, they chose to do that through savings in this experiment, right? So if we hadn't thought about those differences or what certain people prioritize, you know, we could offer this, you know, this agricultural insurance product and say, like, oh no, women wanted this, you know, this was a failure. But you're missing the, I guess, the nuance of the differences between men and women potentially and what is most important to them. So I think, you know, gender-informed product design is number one, right? Really understanding, understanding who your target audience is and making sure that you completely understand what their needs and preferences are. And then I guess in the bigger scheme of things, making sure that there is an enabling environment that is going to give women equal access to these products and services, right? So really understanding what gender-based barriers might still exist that might limit their access to taking advantage of these things. So is it a lack of formal ID? Is it lack of collateral? Is it, you know, reduced mobility or constrained mobility because, you know, I'm not allowed to leave home without a male family member, something like that. Are those things that might limit my access, and are those things that could be addressed from a more kind of enabling environment, you know, approach? And then also, you know, phone ownership. So your comment about the mobile money thing, I think, is totally spot on. You know, we don't know enough about mobile money. A lot of people are pushing this as a solution. We don't know enough about the effects of mobile money. I think, one, you know, again, going back to that gender thing, phone ownership among women is consistently lower, or there might be a single phone per household. Is that giving people equal access? What are the consumer protection issues that we're not, you know, adequately addressing when it comes to mobile money products? And just, you know, welfare impact, like you said, there's two studies that this team of researchers have put out. They're not purely experimental. They're not pure RCTs. They're looking at the growth of M-Pesa over time in areas where people were taking up the product and looking at differences over time and their behavior. But, you know, that's a single study in a really unique environment where there's very large mobile money penetration. That's not a solution that would easily be, you know, picked up and plopped down into another context. So I think your caution, your call for caution is spot on, right? We need to take the results with a grain of salt. And really understand, you know, what was happening in that context, and then is that an appropriate solution? Kind of swinging back to this idea of just digital payments in general, whether it be mobile money or, you know, some other type of payment like debit cards or whatever, there is this question about intra-household bargaining power that is really interesting and is something that we need to continue to do research on. We do have a handful of studies that seem to suggest that, you know, digital tools are, give women more privacy over their funds, like what income they generate and what they do with it, more control over the ability to make choices of how they spend the money. And we do see differences in terms of household welfare as a result, so things like, you know, changes in consumption patterns, nutrition, things like that. The women are obviously making different choices in the way that they're spending their money. Also, you know, business investments, type of business activities that are invested in, things like that. I don't want to suggest that we just go out and push digital payments as a way for women to, you know, hide their money from their spouse and, you know, do their own thing and not tell their spouse what they're doing. That's potentially disastrous for other reasons. I'm not trying to tell people how to, you know, run their marriages or like how to run their households, right? So I think, you know, from when you're looking at some of these outcomes, like these purely like economic, you know, like did income increase? Yes, that's great. Is that actually a win though if we're not understanding the broader intra-household dynamics? What's the right way to use that information?
Okay, so Stefan, I cut you off, and let's go. We've got three in a row, so, but let's start with Stefan since he was disempowered before.
I just had one reaction to this idea that, like, in developing countries, it requires a lot of subsidies and so on. But looking at developed countries, even in places with large subsidies, the only place with penetration larger than 50% are places where it's mandatory. So this is a big elephant in the room, right? Can we make that happen without making it mandatory? And where is the frontier with more like social protection type things? So I was wondering if talking about financial protection wouldn't be like more appropriate to avoid this confusion that this is not just perfect market insurance. Same thing for the pricing. I mean, reinsurance prices in the other countries is more than 100% per more expensive than the expected loss. So these things are expensive also in rich context when you have everything you need. So it's really a difficult thing. And one little comment on the take-up rate. Still in developed countries, you can find that marketing is really good at making people buy things they don't need. So a lot of people have like twice the insurance for everything. So just a question, that's what is the proof that this is really something good? If we invest a lot in convincing people to take them, does it mean it's really good? Maybe. Open question. My question more precise was about intermediate between governments and individuals. I guess for like a cooperative or an association of farmers, it's much easier to manage the basis risks. And I don't hear a lot of this intermediate between these two extremes. So I was wondering if you have pilot topic projects to show to us. And then I stop, I promise. One little thing on the resilience that Chris showed at the beginning. I think it's really interesting. So I've been working on resilience also, and there are many resiliences that exist in the world. And so this, my understanding is you need the distribution of shocks to have been realized because you're observing people going up and down. And so my question is, what about their rare shocks? So if you could just clarify for me how you see that being applied to things that happen only every 50 years or something, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, John Kirk from Mercy Corps. Rebecca, I had a question for you. Thanks for walking us through all those findings. You know, some super encouraging things there. Moving away from the insurance products, which are sort of inherently resilient, specific to some of the other savings and loans credit pieces, wondering how much those are really designed with resilience in mind. So it is encouraging to see that there are potential results for some of them that are essentially secondary outcomes or benefits, if I'm seeing it right. But I'm also wondering if there's a bit of pressure in there to demonstrate impacts on resilience. I mean, I'm glad you caveated the Carlin study. That caught my eye when it came out because the results in the paper actually dismissed them all around resilience. But the press release and others sort of trumps them up. And I understand that tendency, but it's sort of wondering if we're at risk, especially around something like the SLA, where for us we're saying there's actually not much of a theory that we connect that group with meaningful resilience. And so if we're supporting existing technologies, beyond what they're really intended or able to do. I'm worried we're not pushing our field in the right way. So I'm just wanting to see if there is pressure there and then how we might be able to go about looking at these more intentional resilient side versus just the center kind of.
I also just wanted to point out that this is the curse of concurrent sessions, because there was a session on diversifying livelihood risk, and I just wanted to underscore that, to Chris's point, you know, there's a very qualified, or a set of qualifications around diversification, and a lot of what's being presented in that group I know is that when diversification takes the form of diversifying into low return activities merely to manage risk, that in fact it is, does not provide a source of resilience. But where there are investments made in enabling people who are already stepping out or moving out of agriculture, that in fact, if we do invest in those areas, they can be sources of resilience. And I think the call, the general call around the stepping out, moving out is, are we effectively looking at the various pathways people are embarking on versus simply looking at one pathway, an agricultural pathway? So I just want to point out that there's not a contradiction here. Just an unfortunate set of concurrent sessions.
Okay, time for a couple quick responses.
Just quickly, to your comments, absolutely. Yeah, these studies were not designed with the intention of looking at how we can specifically build resilience using these products, right? These are outcomes that we found which suggest that this is we need to do more work, basically. So absolutely. I think the next generation of studies, and something that IPA is aggressively approaching, is, you know, building a portfolio of work that is going to speak to those specific questions. Now that we have these kind of like suggestions or these ideas from this handful of studies, how can we use that information to build products that more specifically, you know, address these outcomes and then test those in a rigorous way, right? So I think that's the next generation of work that needs to happen. So we'd love to work with you on that.
So Stefan, you raise a really good question about what I would call mesoscale insurance. So not nation states as the insurers, where arguably they can already handle some of the risk. Countries you're talking about can't. The United States, we shoulder our own risk because there's enough wealth here to self-insure, versus really micro-scale households where the basis risk is a big problem. Michael can perhaps talk to this. There are a few projects that are looking at insuring, for example, financial institutions or agro-input dealers or others who are essentially picking up the locally covariant risk, and you can thereby dampen some of the basis risk. They're trying to insure a portfolio of borrowers that they might have, you know, those who sell ag inputs on credit to their clients. They're worried about the average repayment they're getting, not each individual's. And there's some promise there, but the evidence base is very thin, even thinner than for the micro products right now. We can talk offline about the assumptions needed. I would just point out that the IBLI evaluation that Jen and Nobu did is using data that encompasses the 2011 drought. So there is a major drought event that happens. Methodologically, as with any other study, if we don't observe it happen in sample, you can't estimate anything off of it. So your criticism is well-founded. You know, we have to project through modeling, you know, shocks that we don't actually observe to estimate what happens then. And then we have to make a lot of strong assumptions, so I'm a little cautious.
Well, I'll just, since Chris invited me, just very, I'll just make two very quick comments that I think tie to two of your comments, Stefan. I mean, number one, I think to the extent there is evidence that this works, we do see large crowding in impacts, largely from the producer side. You know, there can be restrictions of credit supply, say creditors don't want to lend, and that certainly is a problem, and portfolio insurance might speak to that. But I think the impact studies that are there now show that it's really important. Now, the reason I link those things together, I mean, number one, that's a possible answer to your question. You know, why is it a good deal? Is that actually when it works and people invest more, it's a very high rate of return kind of investment to get that insurance up and moving. But if a lot of the impacts actually come from people feeling emboldened to prudentially invest more and frankly, to become less diversified. I mean, in Mali, we see people investing more in cotton, and they are, you know, they're moving away from a traditional risk management system that makes them better off on average. But it's important, obviously, for those people to know they're protected or they're not going to do that. And a lot of meso products suffer with that, how to do that, how to maintain repayment costs. culture, as it's sometimes called, etc. Right. The other thing to be real careful on is a lot of what I would call a stupidly designed index insurance contracts. The basis risk that they contain includes what I call design risk, which means the insurance contract does not even protect against covariant shocks. Okay, it's just bad. I mean, so in other words, there's two reasons a contract can fail. It doesn't correctly predict the covariant or the common risk, and it doesn't cover against individual risk. We often mistakenly think that's what basis risk is, but it's only a component. And so I think when we think about it, so insuring meso-level institutions doesn't remove the basis risk problem. It removes the idiosyncratic risk problem, but not the design risk problem, where, like, rainfall contracts, for example, will even at Africa risk capacity, I think, I don't want to get you, I don't want to say it wrong, but I thought I heard the Malawi, there was some dispute over exactly the initial readings that came out of at that highly aggregated level. Is that wrong? So I can retract it, or you don't want to say it. Now I put it on the spot.
Actually, I was talking to someone about that. I was talking to someone in the hall about that actually here yesterday, whether or not that's actually a basis risk event. We had a data input issue, actually. So it wasn't a pure, the crop that was being planted, that the government told us was going to be planted most commonly in the areas that were being insured, wasn't what was actually being planted. It was a different type of seed. And so there was a dispute over it, because there were impacts that would have been caught if the correct input seed had been included. So it's not exactly a basis risk event, but the result is more or less the same. And then in that case, we were able to re-input the correct information and then come up with a payment. In a real basis risk event, there's often just a disconnect between the model and reality that isn't explainable so easily, but the result on us was the same, in that there was a discrepancy, and you know, it makes the it causes doubts about your product.
Good. All right, well, thank you all for your